Episode 172B, the continuation of the interview with Jim Carmack, Epistogrammas and Beyond.
You know, I caught a new species once of catfish in a tributary of the Ucayali that was metallic gold with purple stripes. It was the first one ever caught. It's called the Flash Tigrinus. First one anybody'd ever seen. I caught it on hook and line at about 100 feet, and it was about 16 inches long. And I caught a second one that was about 10 inches long, and I brought that one back to the United States with me, and I sold that to a catfish guy in Chicago for $2,600.
Wow.
And, and he was
like disco
he was
fish.
Thrilled. He was thrilled to get it.
I bet.
But like Scott and I, from the aquarium, we're collecting with Dr. Chow in Brazil. And Scott had come up with the idea of using what's called an otter trawl, which we use on the... I live in Scituate, Massachusetts, and we're right on the coast. I mean, I could throw a rock into the water from where I live. And the otter trawl is like what we call them doors, which are like planks that are held open by the forward movement of the boat. And it acts to hold the net throat open so you can tow it behind you. And it's like this long pocket. And we towed it through the Rio Negro, and we brought up 40 species that had never been seen before.
Wow.
That's amazing.
It is.
And what's even more sobering is we took a radar image of the Rio Negro, and we took a sonar image of the Rio Negro. And the two are totally different. Because there is anywhere from 20 to 100 feet of broken up trees and driftwood on the bottom. And we have no idea what's living in there.
Yeah.
We can't sample that properly. That's a whole benthic environment. You can't get down there with scuba gear. I've tried, and it's dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous. It's just a tangle of rotting trees and limbs and structure down there. And there's stuff living down there that God knows. I mean, we caught a almost blind pink knife fish that was bright, bright pink with fluorescent red fins. Fluorescent red anus.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
The colors are amazing.
Some of the stuff was just amazing. We caught a catfish, looked kind of like a shovel nose, but not really, and its whiskers were four times longer than its body.
Like a longhorn beetle.
And its tail filaments were 2.5 times longer than its body.
Wow.
No idea why they have these or how. I mean, and we caught a Rhinodorus, of which there were only 2 specimens in existence at the time that had ever been caught. We caught all kinds of cool stuff. And it's just serendipity, though. You're not really sampling. You're just kind of... It's so sobering thinking that how little we know of we work so hard to get so much information, we still know so little.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Getting back, really. Yep. Getting back to Epistogrammas and how they do in aquariums.
Mm-hmm.
I still bring in wild Epistogrammas. I put them into a tank with a lot of driftwood and 50% rainwater, 50% tap water. My tap water is pretty soft and acid anyway, but rainwater is absolute magic. We had a very, very good breeder down here named Leo Godori, who I was working with bringing in wild fish and giving him to breed. And Leo had a reverse osmosis unit for salt water, and he was using the water for his epistos, and he just wasn't having any luck. And I said, Leo, you got to try some rainwater. Here's a couple buckets. And he called me up a week later and he goes, Jim, I had 3 species spawned using that rainwater. What do? Peeing it? I go, no, I have my wife. He said, yeah, it's special magic rainwater. I said, I said, I forgot to tell you, Leo, it's $10 a gallon.
I said, yeah.
But we put in a rainwater collection system for them. Now, being a chemist, and I was dating a woman who worked for an analytical laboratory, I was able to do chemical analysis of water coming off the roofs. And I found that if it's an asphalt roof, that the water is perfectly fine within 6 months of the roof being applied. You shouldn't use the water for the first, say, year. But after that, after the roof's 6 months or a year old, you're good to go. And there's nothing in it except, you know, a little debris and leaves and things like that. And Leo was able to spawn about 25 species of Pistos that he could not spawn in RO water.
And, just using the rainwater.
Using rainwater.
Yeah.
And we found something else very interesting. When we were working with Dichrosis, we kept having Dichrosis turn yellow using our tap water. They would turn this beautiful gold color, but they wouldn't spawn. So I killed a couple and macerated them and gave them to my girlfriend to analyze, and she said they're full of iron and manganese. And I said, what? I said, the wild ones aren't. She goes, no, the wild ones have none at all in them. And I said, very interesting. Because these fish come from what Goulding describes as slightly contaminated distilled water, there are no minerals in it. You know, it is essentially rainwater with that has a little bit of organics for color, and that's it. There's no calcium, there's no phosphorus, there's no nitrogen, there's no nothing in it. So these fish become very, very, very good at concentrating whatever minerals that are there. And when you do give them things like manganese and calcium, they end up with depositing them in their scales, and their growth increases dramatically. You can grow a Rio Negro fish very, very fast by putting them in water with a little tiny bit of hardness, but you're apt to screw up his ovaries. The testes don't seem to be affected, but the ovaries seem to get calcium deposits and they won't spawn. So you got to be very, very careful to keep brooding fish, potential brooding fish, in dead soft water with very low mineral content, or you can screw up their future life.
That is fascinating. That makes a lot of sense, but I had never heard that before.
Yeah, and you don't think about it. You don't really think about what these minerals, you know, I have a little bit of this, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And we're not talking, my total dissolved solids is about 27 here.
So really
we're not talking, really, I mean, we're basically tap water here. I mean, rainwater here in Scituate. We have
pretty
a surface reservoir. They do nothing but chlorinate it and adjust the pH to 7.0. using caustic soda. So it's got and you know, by the time it gets to me, it's down to about 6.6, and it's got 1 degree of hardness, and, you know, the TDS is just from the caustic soda.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. That's why I like it, because I do 90 to 150% water changes. Many times, like in my big tanks, I'll drain the water down to 2 or 3 inches, and I'll run the water in one end and out the other. I spray the water in through a device I've made that takes the gases out of the water. But, you know, I'll literally flush the tank out and then fill it back up again. And it's very, very beneficial for a lot of fish that are used to rivers. You know,
right.
Some plecos and things like that. Like gold tiger plecos, you gotta do that 2 or 3 times, and all of a sudden you'll see babies appear. And very, very hot water.
Give them a kind of a spawning trigger too, I imagine. Then.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes you go up, sometimes you go down. Like you got to be really careful of dropping temperature, because it's a good way to give them dick. But for most corridors that I have spawned, I found the most successful trigger is to drain 3/4 of the water out of the tank and fill it back up with cold water, which here is about 58 degrees. And that ends up with a tank going from like 78 degrees down to like 64, 65 degrees, and then coming right back up again to 78 degrees. Now, this is exactly what happens in South America. The rains come, you get this pulse of cold water washing down, cold, pure water washing down through it. And the water level goes up a couple feet, and then it drops again, and the water starts to warm up. And that's when the fish spawn, is right after that rainy pulse. And I was in the Napo in July one year, and we had heard that there were rains way, way upriver, and we had to watch out for flash floods. We heard on the radio, and we had tied our boat up so that we would make sure we wouldn't be torn loose or anything. And during the night, the water level came up almost 3 feet. Now, the water had been receding for, maybe 2 weeks, and this was an unexpected rainstorm. So the water level went up 3 feet and came down again. Now, all the new growth that had been right down to the water the day before was completely denuded. There were nothing but bare branches left when that water level went back down from that 3 foot level. The silver dollars and the pacus and everything else had come in and eaten every single green leaf.
Wow.
That's why you never see aquarium. I've never collected fish with aquarium plants in an area where there's aquarium plants. I've collected aquarium plants, but there were no fish there. There was hot, stagnant, usually mud holes, and the plants were growing profusely. But generally where there's fish, they'll eat the plants. Only in a few areas. I was in Queens Lake off of Rio de Mini, and there is a beautiful mossy plant. I'm not even sure the name of it, although I could probably look it up, that grows everywhere. And it's being heavily fed on by the silver dollars and the wimple piranhas that are in there. And the wimple piranhas are also feeding on the other silver dollars that are there. And yet it grows so fast that you have these, the whole lake is about 12 feet deep, and there were these perfectly vertical channels that have been eaten by the fish trying to, and this plant grows so fast that the plant stays ahead of it, of the attentions of the fish. Because the lake is fairly shallow, it's and open, the birds have a chance to pick off the fish before they can overwhelm the biotope. It's pretty cool. Nature is amazing. It's just amazing.
That's
now,
great.
It just occurred to me, I came up one creek one time, a Clearwater Creek in Brazil, and it was loaded with cabamba, and it was very cool. It was about 74 degrees, and there were Dicrosis filamentosa and Dicrosis maculata everywhere. Millions of them in that creek. Every time I picked up a dip net, I would catch those, and I would catch Crenicicla, not ophthalmus. And that seemed to be 50% of the biomass in that creek.
Hmm.
There were
one of the exceptions where you'll find the aquarium plants and the fish together, but
yep,
not a very common occurrence.
No, not a very common one, because wherever the silver dollar clan has access, it's like, see you later, Joe. they're voracious. We've seen them just, we were taking heads of lettuce and tossing them out, and just the water boils. It's like shark week. Yeah, they're something else.
Lettuce feeding frenzy.
Little lawnmower fish.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific? Do you have any specific questions on any of my travels or collecting, or whatever?
Let's see. One we had was when you collect the epistos. One thing you mentioned is you'd often find them in leaf litter.
Yes.
What else about that that biotope where you collected the epistos? Could you say anything characteristic that might be surprising for aquarists who breed epistos, for example?
Well, what what I found surprising about a lot of leaf litter, especially in Peru, was the leaf litter was 20 and 30 feet deep.
Wow.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Yeah, we took sample cores down. And because we're not really sure of the reason, but in certain really acidic environments, the leaves don't break down from bacteria. They only break down from fungus. And the fungus only can break it down under certain circumstances. So you get almost like a layering of layer upon layer upon layer upon layer upon of leaves with no oxygen, and so there's no decomposition, and the water will look just like Coca-Cola. Just, I mean, you can barely see into it. It's so dark. And
sort of like
pH
a peat bog.
You're like a peat bog. Like a peat bog, but instead of bits of pieces like we have here, which I think is because of the seasons, we have hot, cold, hot, cold. I never encountered a peat bog in warm, now that I think about it, I never encountered a peat bog in warm climates. Mud bogs, but no peat bogs. But in these leafy areas, the leaf litter structure is probably, biologically active leaf litter structure is probably 4 to 10 inches thick, meaning that at the very top of the leaf litter are the little epistogrammas and the things like that. Now, as you go down into the leaf litter, now it doesn't get really packed down until you get down a ways, but in that loose conglomeration of leaves and sticks and litter, as it gets more and more packed down, like in a foot down in the leaf litter, where you wouldn't think there'd be any oxygen at all, there are all these little whiptail catfish and cymbranchid eels and knife fishes of all kinds, all living in the same environment as these little epistogrammas. But the epistogrammas seem to be in the water interface, and a lot of the rest of these guys are in the leaf mud interface, searching for the little critters that live down there, the mud lava, the insect lava, things like that. Whereas the epistos seem to be searching for, when I watched them underwater, in one area that was Coca-Cola colored, and maybe a foot of water with maybe 6 inches of loose leaves in the bottom. And I was careful just to put my mask in and not disturb it. And they go, and I saw this female that had babies. And she's going along leading the babies, and they're just picking on the mold in the bottom. And she would go and flip over leaves. And every so often she would dart forward and grab something. And but for the most part, they're just feeding on, we call it grut, which is a broken up leaf matter with the paramecium and whatever little critters are growing in there, chironomid lava or daphnia or God knows what. But generally, acid water, especially in the Rio Negro, does not produce high levels of primary productivity in any way, shape, or form. It's just not much there. A lot of it is terrestrial-derived, which is why the leaves are just so important as a resource for these fish. Leaves, fruit, things like that drive the little bit of ostracods and copepods and daphnia that are present in the water. But there's not much for fish to eat, though. It's an amazingly hard existence. The Rio Negro, for instance, has 400 species of fish that are less than an inch long at adult size.
Wow.
400 species of fish. I mean, they also have Cichla ocellaris that gets 4 feet long, but it's a lot easier to make a living if you only have to be an inch than it is if you have to make a living if you're 4 feet long.
Right.
Well, if you're going to be 4 feet long, you better plan on eating some of your neighbors. if if you're an inch, you can get away with eating a lot of other stuff. But, you know, once you get to a certain size, if you're not a predator or you have other adaptations, for instance, what we call a paku, and they call it tambaki down there, makes a lot of its living from eating rubber tree fruit. And the rubber tree has evolved a really cool trick in that its seed is extremely slippery inside the fruit itself. And that if you are a fish and you're eating the fruit and you're trying to bite into this seed and crack it, you only get to crack it about half the time. The other half of the time, the seed gets away from you. And about half of that time, the seed goes down your throat and you swallow it. And if that happens to a rubber tree seed, then will the rubber tree seed be germinated. It has to pass through the gut of a fish. You can do it artificially by scratching it with a file and hitting it with acid and doing a couple other things. But you just take a rubber tree seed and plant it, it's not going to, it won't sprout. It's evolved, to go through the system of a paku. Now, in doing so, the fish has traded this cool way of making a living for a very small window of food opportunity. So big paku only feed for 4 to 6 months out of the year, and then they go hungry for the other 4 to 6 months.
Wow.
So, yeah. And, I mean, I once set up a fish tank, a Rio Negro tank, and I set it up with some live plants and driftwood, and a light was on a timer, and I put cardinals and corydoras and a pyralina and a little pair of epistos in there. No, it was a little pair of pulmentosa in there. And I didn't feed the tank. I fed everybody for like a month after I got them from the wild. And then I set up this little tank, and I didn't feed it. I didn't feed it for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months went by. The fish still looked fine. I hadn't fed them one drop of food. Nothing had died. Everything was fine. The plants were growing. I didn't know what the fish were eating. They were thin, but they were by no means emaciated or overly skinny. And what they were living on was what they live on in nature. Just the protozoans and the microfauna that's growing everywhere. And at 9 months, I ended the experiment and started feeding them. And it was remarkable. I had got no breeding activity at all. And nothing had grown very much. And within 6 weeks of feeding, the cardinal tetras had doubled in size. And they hadn't grown much at all. They grew very, very little in the previous 9 months. And everything seemed to catch up when they had food availability given to them. They were waiting for that chance to get those calories in them to turn that into body mass. And as soon as I started feeding them, the filamentosa, which I thought were two females, one turned into a male, and they bred 2 weeks later. As soon as food became available.
Amazing, they're just waiting for that chance
that's
hanging out.
Waiting for that influx of food. So, we are all of the opinion that you got to keep feeding your fish, feeding your fish, feeding your fish. But that's an unrealistic interpretation of what goes on in nature.
Right.
You know, nature's got cycles of feast and famine.
Right.
You know, and when there's a lot of water, a lot of food, you better make babies. And when there isn't, you probably shouldn't.
Yeah, it's amazing how that can be such a limiting factor, and yet they're primed as soon as it's available, they switch the other way.
Right. Now, in other fish, there are other factors that limit their breeding seasons. In some cases, it's predators. Like we saw Brycon and Brychonopsis schools along with flagkill Pocholotus. Huge schools, I'm talking acres, a school 3, 4, 5 acres across of foot-long Pocholotus leaping up the river, coming up to the Amazon, being pursued by schools of tiger shovelnose. part of a whole spawning migration for both species.
Wow.
Yep. The poor Brycon are going up to spawn, and the tiger shovel nose are following, and figure, well, we got a full stomach, and may as well breed while we're here.
Yeah,
so,
multitasking, right?
Yeah. And I'm talking thousands of tiger shovel nose. Thousands. We saw one area where the water level had suddenly dropped over a course of about 3 days, and there were at least 30,000 dead Lima shovel nose floating on the surface of the water.
Goodness.
That had been, when the water level dropped, the water went stagnant, and they'd been traveling through, and they just, there was so many of them, they just sucked all the oxygen out of the canal there, and they died by the boatload.
Wow.
Nature's, yeah, it's funny, you know. In some areas, you'll see so many fish will be migrating in one area that they temporarily deplete the oxygen in that area, and they have to. You'll see them all gasping at the surface.
That's amazing. It's hard to picture in your head that many fish in one spot.
Oh yeah, you know what some people don't realize is how fish are shipped out of the jungle. Most fish are shipped in a box that's 16 inches across by 32 inches long by 10 inches deep. And they nest these boxes and they ship them up to Barcelos. And then they if you turn them 90 degrees, 180 degrees, you can stack them. And they'll put 1,000 cardinal tetras in one of these boxes with less than an inch of water. Because if you put too much water in, they drown, they say. And what it is if you put just a little bit of water in, the fish's action of swimming back and forth aerates the water. Because
and there's
shallow
enough oxygen in that available air that
right.
It works.
Right. You put them in 4 inches of water, they're all dead. You put them in 3/4 of an inch of water, they're all alive. And, you know,
Fish of the water, too.
And, you know, we saw boats with a million cardinal tetras on them being shipped down. 38 million cardinal tetras are shipped out of the wild every year with no diminution of the resource at all. It's the perfect fish to base a fishery on because it goes through such a pinch during the dry season that most of them get wiped out anyway. If you don't collect them, they're going to die. And,
right. Aren't they caught in a lot of those places where you were talking about earlier where it's flooded forest and then
right.
The water recedes and they get stuck in pools where they would die?
That's right. And the birds have a good time. And the turtles and the piranhas before they get, and the crocodiles. You know, what happens, little fish get eaten by the medium fish and then they get eaten by the big fish and then the big fish get eaten by a crocodile. But, yeah. I've seen mud holes that had nothing left but, you know, 200, 300 piranhas in them, you know, and, it, you know, 2 inches of hot mud and all these poor piranhas dying and all these jarabu storks and everything feeding on them, and along with caiman and everything else. But, yeah, the ones that do survive can repopulate the area pretty well. And what Brazil has done is institute a series of rotating preserves, so you can fish here. You can fish here right now, but not here. You know, and every year they change it to a different river. You know, you can't fish Zamula. You know, every 5 years one area is closed, and that just gives it a rest. You know, so you can't keep hammering the stock year after year after year.
Right.
And there's a closed season now for the cardinals while they're spawning. You need to be licensed, a licensed fisherman to be a collector. But the really nice thing about it is, like, there's no bycatch. When they go out with what they call the hapache, which is a highlight net, you know, one of those things they use for highlight, it's a long scoop with a handle across the middle. And
right.
they just put it under the cardinals. Now, cardinals don't occur in big schools. They occur in little family groups. Four or five good-sized fish, and maybe a dozen little guys. And that's it. But there'll be one little group here, another little group 5 feet away, another group 10 feet away from them. And they'll go around and they'll harvest these up, and they'll let the little ones go, and they'll keep the big ones. And if they catch something they don't want, they'll throw it back. If they do want, it goes in a different bucket. But there's no bycatch. There's extremely low impact to the environment. You know, stuff isn't getting caught in one place and released in another place,
right,
which happened in Malawi a lot. And now you've got fish in Malawi that don't belong in, like Homer Island is a mess because of people releasing fish where they didn't belong. And, the green discus in Peru, you know, that's not native, right?
Know
that?
I didn't know that, no.
No, the green discus in Peru was escapees, and I've collected them. And I got the whole story from a guy. Back in 1962, there was a discus operation there where they would catch discus in Brazil and bring them up there and acclimate them and ship them back out. And this was in Iquitos. And one of the guys decided to have the bright idea of setting up a breeding operation down off of the Rio Mamon. Well, that lasted until the high water came, and all the pens got destroyed, and all the discus escaped. And that was it. Yep. And
they were suddenly established.
Yep. Well, what's also established down there is gold gouramis.
Not even the right continent.
Nope. But you go down there, you can catch gold gouramis and blue gouramis.
Oh,
yeah, some of them have reverted back. But they're not doing very well. You don't catch them very often. They do have a niche there that they like, where not much can eat them. You know, they can live in something that nothing else can live in, you know, where there's no oxygen at all and really, really hot. So there are a couple biotopes in South America that they fit right into, but yeah, they try to wander out of them and everything eats them. So that's unfortunate. Any other questions that you can think of?
Well,
this has been fascinating.
I think what I would like to ask you now is, could we ask you again to come on the show again? Because there's so much we'd like to talk to you about.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like I say, I've been, people said, I get an offer one time, you want to go to Rome and London. I'm like, no, not really. I'm going to go to the Cameroon instead. You're going to go to a filthy, poor country and go into the jungle and into swamps? And I go, yeah. I don't want to go where people are, you know, where people have been for 1,000 years. I want to go where, you know, there's been a white man before. You know, I want to go into cool places. I want to see things that, I want to collect fish that nobody's collected before. You know, and try to search out new ideas and new areas and I mean, there's just so much about fishing and catching fish and observing fish that is just in the wild. You can go, oh, well, that's why they do that, you know, or like marble hatchets. You know, I was in this beautiful area in Brazil one time, and I was sneaking around a corner because we knew there were some jarabu storks down the way, and we wanted to sneak up on them. And my paddle slipped, and I slapped the water, and about 300 marble hatchets leaped out of the water, flew about 5 feet, and went back into the water.
Wow.
And you'd never see that in captivity. You know?
No, I've always wanted that.
I mean, you go, oh, that's what that keel is for, you know? They're little miniature flying fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you find them on the floor, you kind of, oh, they jumped out. But, you know, realize that they fly. These things really fly. They can soar you know, I mean, I've seen silver hatchets go 10 feet, you know, or pyrolina or copina. You know, I watched a copella, I forget what species it was, the splash tetra under a leaf splashing his eggs, you know, trying to get them, you know, waiting for them to hatch and fall into the water. I mean, there's so much in down there that it's just so cool. I mean, I would go, I made a lot of trips to South America and made no money at all doing it. But I had so much fun and learned
and
so much.
That's a reason to go, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I mean, if I even just paid for my trip, I was ecstatic. You know,
yeah.
Generally,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, I this is supposedly a business. I mean, the IRS came to me and they said, "You're telling us you spent $83,000 on collecting trips?" I go, "Well, yeah. How much did you make?" "How much did you make back?" I go, "Oh, I don't know, 30,000. But I had a good time, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, and also you bring back stuff and you breed it, and you know, there's fish that are in the hobby today that I introduced.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
The chocolate cichlid that's in the hobby today are from specimens that Scott and I collected in 1988 in the Rio Yuca Ailey. The real nice reddish brown one with the green, the temporalis, that's available in New York City and New Jersey and all those areas of the tank race. That's all from our stock.
That's a pretty amazing legacy to have to see,
you know,
fish.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I did
cool.
That.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I was lucky enough. I was friends with Pierre Bouchard, and I mentioned to Pierre that I was trying to spawn Cynodonis catfish. And he said, "How are you at Multipunctatus?" He said, "How are you trying to do it?" And I said, "Well, I have caves, and I have this, and I have that." And he goes, "Well, you need cichlids in there with them." I go, "Why?" He says, "They're cuckoo spawners." I said, "What? What are you talking about?" He says, "We have found baby catfish in the mouths of cichlids." So, and he said, "Also, they eat snails. So you have to give them snails to get them in condition." So I started giving them snails, and I put cichlids in with them, and for 6 months, nothing happened. So I said, "The heck with it." Threw them into a 125-gallon community tank, and 2 weeks later, I pulled a brooding female minutus out of there and shook the babies out, and in among the babies was 6 baby Multipunctatus catfish. I just sheer luck, I was the first one to do it, you know, and that was how we learned that Multipunctatus really were cuckoo spawners. Pierre Bouchard had told me anecdotally that he had found babies, and he said, "They don't seem to be eating them. They seem to pick them up." And I said, "How do they get there?" He says, "I think they spawn." And he goes, "Why are you asking me?" He goes, "You know how to spawn fish." So,
as I said, it's fascinating, and we would like to talk to you again. I think we're going to have to go now, but we'd like to thank you. We've learned a lot about epistogrammas and beyond. So
let me know.
I'm sure our listeners
too. They're going to eat this up.
If you would care to have just an epistogramma discussion some night, we could talk about how to spawn certain different species. But generally, you keep them in clean, soft water and feed them good food and give them good water changes. They'll spawn. You know, there's very, very few tricks to them. You know, it's not like a lot of fish. But give me a call anytime. I'm usually available on Monday nights. That's our water change night. And except the third Monday, which is our Boston Aquarium Society meeting. I'll put a plug in for our local club. I've been a member there since 1966, and I gave my first talk there in 1967. That was a while ago, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks,
well,
guys.
It's
been a pleasure. I'll talk to you.
For us too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Bye-bye. You're welcome. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.